From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, two writers who have published their first books. Manil Suri is the author of The Death of Vishnu, inspired by his childhood growing up in a crowded Bombay apartment building in which a homeless man lived on the stairwell's landing. Peter Hessler's new book, Rivertown, is about his 2 years in the Peace Corps teaching English in Fulong, China. An excerpt was published in The New Yorker. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush called a news conference today to push for his $1.6 trillion tax cut proposal. He appeared with three families from lower tax brackets, saying that they'd be the beneficiaries of his plan. The president said the tax code should not punish success at any stage of life. The Bush plan would replace the current five tax brackets with four. It would reduce taxes for the lowest bracket from 15% to 10% and for the highest bracket from 39.6% to 33%. Democrats complained that the Bush plan is too large and said it could throw the economy back into deficit spending. They also say the cut disproportionately favors the rich. Israelis are preparing to vote for prime minister tomorrow. The polls show challenger Ariel Sharon leading Prime Minister Ehud Barak. Barak says the vote is a choice between peace and violence. We have two reports, the first from NPR's Jennifer Ludden.
Writing in the Israeli newspaper Yediot Ahronot, Barak said tomorrow's vote will decide whether between us and peace there is another blood-filled war. It was his latest attack on Sharon as an ultra-hawk likely to intensify confrontation. For his part, Sharon has vowed not to negotiate with Palestinians until they end a violent four-month-old uprising. Barak, in a last-minute scramble for votes, has defended the sweeping compromises he offered Palestinians, insisting there's no other solution to the conflict. Sharon, virtually assured of victory, has ended a lackluster campaign by canceling several appearances. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Jerusalem.
I'm Dale Gablack in Cairo. Dr. Abdelmenem Sayed of Cairo's El Ahram Strategic Center said Arab leaders believe Sharon will halt peace efforts and escalate the bloodshed with the Palestinians. He said there will be a period of wait and see to look at the repercussions of Sharon's position. He said the Arabs expect more lives will be lost, so they will concentrate their efforts on how to make Sharon's term in office as short as possible. Sayed said Egypt may be prepared to use its remaining diplomatic and commercial ties with Israel if Sharon chooses to step up Israel's military confrontation with the Palestinians. He added that Egypt will be looking to U.S. and European support to rein in Sharon. For NPR News, I'm Dale Gavlak in Cairo.
A former employee opened fire today at a suburban Chicago engine plant, killing four people and wounding four others before committing suicide. Police say William Baker was fired from the Navistar International plant for stealing. He was supposed to begin serving a five-month prison term tomorrow. Witnesses said Baker, who was 66, walked through the huge building firing an AK-47 assault rifle. In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 102 points to close at 10,966 in moderate trading. The Nasdaq lost 17 points to close at 2643. This is NPR News. The Swiss Bankers Association has published a list of 21,000 dormant bank accounts which could possibly belong to Holocaust victims. This brings the number of accounts traced by the U.S. Volcker Commission to 36,000. Potential beneficiaries will be paid compensation from a fund set up following a $1.25 billion settlement with Swiss banks. The banks have admitted they prevented Holocaust survivors from withdrawing money deposited during the Nazi era. Claire Duell reports from Geneva.
The 21,000 dormant bank accounts, whose details are published on the internet, are believed to belong to those who may have been the victims of Nazi persecution. Anyone whose name is listed can make a claim to a tribunal based in Zurich. If proven, the claimant will receive a share of the settlement agreed between Swiss banks and Jewish organizations some 2.5 years ago. Two of Switzerland's biggest banks agreed to an out-of-court settlement rather than face a series of legal cases launched by Holocaust victims and their families. The commission, which has traced possible beneficiaries, has already published other lists of account holders during the Nazi era. But the claims process is very slow, and so far, very little money has been paid out. For NPR News, this is Claire Doul in Geneva.
A judge in Houston, Texas, has sentenced a man to 10 years in prison for leading a cross burning at a black family's home. 21-year-old Matthew Marshall pleaded guilty to violating the civil rights of the family in the attack last summer. Four other men who took part in the cross burning received sentences of 3 years or less. Marshall's attorney said the incident was the result of drug and alcohol abuse rather than racism. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new novel, The Death of Vishnu, asks many questions about what is human and what is divine, and why some people have faith in God and others cannot. The novel is set in a Bombay apartment building inhabited by Hindu families and one Muslim family. A homeless man named Vishnu lives on the landing of the stairs. The review in the New York Times Sunday Book Review described The Death of Vishnu as a beguiling and deceptively ambitious novel. An excerpt of the novel was published in The New Yorker. It's the first novel by my guest Manil Suri. He was born in Bombay in 1959 and grew up there in an apartment building very similar to the one in his novel. He came to the U.S. to study at the age of 20. He's a professor of mathematics at the University of Maryland. Let's start with a reading from the opening of The Death of Vishnu.
Not wanting to arouse Vishnu in case he hadn't died yet, Mrs. Asrani tiptoed down to the third step above the landing on which he lived, tea kettle in hand. Vishnu lay sprawled on the stone, his figure aligned with the curve of the stairs. The laces of a pair of sneakers twined around the fingers of one hand, the other lay outstretched as if trying to pull his body up the next step. During the night, Mrs. Asrani noted with distress, Vishnu had not only thrown up, but also soiled himself. She had warned her neighbor, Mrs. Pathak, not to feed Vishnu when he was so sick, but did that woman ever listen? She tried not to look at the large stain spreading through the worn material of Vishnu's khaki pants, the ones that her husband had given him last Diwali. What a mess! The Jamardarni would have to be brought in to clean up such a mess, and it would not be free either. Someone would have to pay. Her large frame heaving against the sari in which it was swaddled, Mrs. Asrani peered at Vishnu from the safety of the third step and vowed it would not be her.
That's Manil Suri reading from his new novel, The Death of Vishnu. Would you describe the character of Vishnu who's living on the landing of the staircase in this apartment building?
Yeah, Vishnu was a real person, I should say, in the beginning. He was someone who was a fixture of my childhood. He would always be on the stairs. He lived on this landing between the ground and the first floor. And he would always say salam to me. He would often be drunk. He would run errands for people in the building, and you couldn't pay him too much because he would just spend it on drinks.
Now, is this kind of typical in apartment buildings in Bombay where you grew up, that someone would be living in the landing of the staircase?
Yes, it was. Space is at such a premium in Bombay that every little scrap of space is important. Someone like Vishnu would be better off than someone truly on the street where the monsoons would rain down upon them.
So, and was it also typical that they would do odd jobs in return for living on that staircase?
It was more like they did the jobs for the inhabitants and were paid for that. And what happened was that there was this symbiosis between them because the people lived on the stairs, and as a result, people, robbers, could not come up and rob the apartments. And, of course, they performed errands for the inhabitants as well, and in return they got shelter and sometimes food and money.
Now, your book is in part about the death of this character. How did the real Vishnu die?
Well, I went back home in 94, and Vishnu was very sick, and he was on the steps, and I remember someone left a cup of tea for him, and that was untouched. And I was actually not well that time. I had chicken pox, and my mother started giving me reports about his condition. And it only took about 2 days or something, and she was telling me that the police just came and took his body away.
Now, the main character in your novel is named Vishnu, and that's the same name as the god Vishnu. What is he the god of?
He's the god of preservation. Vishnu is the caretaker of the universe. And it was very interesting when I started this. I started it as a short story, and I wrote the first chapter and didn't really even think that there's a similarity between Vishnu, the caretaker of the building, and Vishnu, the preserver of the universe. And someone pointed out to me, wait a second, you can't write a story, have your main character named Vishnu, and not say anything about the god Vishnu. I didn't know that much about Hindu mythology. I didn't know that much. I hadn't read the Gita, the Bhagavad Gita. So I started looking at these things and trying to see if there were any dramatic possibilities in them, which could somehow be woven into the story.
Now, you were brought up Hindu, even though you thought of yourself as an agnostic. Did your parents, were your parents religious?
My father is a very religious Hindu. He actually makes sure that he goes to a church and a mosque and everything to cover all bases. My mother is actually a Sikh. I was brought up Hindu, and then I think, I forget if I was 14 or 15 or 16 or older, but I decided I had to rebel somehow. So religion was one way that I did it, and I just said, I'm going to become an atheist. And then perhaps the mathematician in me said, well, that's not quite fair. Maybe that's too harsh, so let's be an agnostic. That's that tempers things a little. And that's how I came to writing this novel. At that stage, I was an agnostic. And reading these texts was initially a purely intellectual exercise.
And it became something else?
It did, I think. I just feel that my life has changed in many ways. Just the kinds of goals that one tries to aspire towards and the ideals that one has, they have changed.
How?
Well, I'll give you one example. Before reading the Bhagavad Gita, I was very obsessed with getting published. I had tried for many years, and the only thing I had to show for that was one very short thing called The Tyranny of Vegetables, and that too was in Bulgarian. It wasn't even in English, and I couldn't show it to anyone. I didn't even know the name of the journal it was in because I couldn't read it. It was in Cyrillic. So after that, after reading this, I just sort of said, well, wait a second. I've been sending things out, and I've got 50 or 60 rejection letters. Let me just work on this, which is very enjoyable, work on this novel and try to finish it and not worry about what happens afterwards.
Now, the cliche would be that the math part of your personality is the very rational part, and the writer part of your personality is the more intuitive, dreamy part. Would that just be a cliche, or is there any truth to that?
I think in math, too, you have to let your mind sort of wander. When I am trying to prove a theorem, for instance, I really have to let go and just let my mind float around and try to maybe even rifle through all the theorems or all the results that I've seen. And it's almost by fluke that sometimes you happen to come upon the right thing. And that process is similar in writing, where you just let your mind wander again and try to come up with characters or situations or ways to resolve different settings.
Now, you're doing that kind of high-level math that most people who aren't mathematicians can't really understand. Can you tell us something that will give us an insight into the kind of math that you do?
Oh, I'd be happy to fill the rest of the hour with that, if you'd like. I keep threatening people in the publishing business that I'm going to give them a lecture complete with slides and everything. And no one's taken me up on my offer yet. But the kind of math that I do is very applied. I work with engineers. Engineers, especially in mechanical engineering or structural analysis, often come up with very complicated sets of equations, which they need to solve to make sure that the components they're designing are strong enough to withstand stresses. And what my field does is it looks at the methods of approximating these equations that these engineers come up with, abstracts them, and analyzes them to see if they do work, if they do work in all possible settings, and gives them some sort of reassurance or validation that their methods are accurate, or if they're not accurate, what kinds of errors they can get. It's called numerical analysis.
Now, is it a relief in a way to work in literature where, like, the worst thing that can go wrong is that it's dull, but there isn't going to be, like, a building that collapses?
Well, mathematicians like to claim that everything revolves around them, that if some disaster occurs, it's due to the mathematician. But it's usually the engineer who has to shoulder that responsibility. So there is quite a bit of freedom in the abstractions that mathematicians play with. So that wasn't so much of the relief. The relief was that you have much fewer constraints in fiction. You can really take your characters anywhere, pretty much. I mean, you can define them to be anything. In mathematics, since I do applied mathematics, I do have to look at the physical problem and obey the laws of physics, and I'm constrained in that way. There is a branch of mathematics called pure mathematics where, again, people start with some assumptions and then just build a theory based on that.
Okay. Well, that's enough about the math, isn't it?
Well, I don't think so.
My guest is Manil Suri. His new novel is called The Death of Vishnu. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Manil Suri, and he's a mathematician and writer. His first novel has just been published to excellent reviews. It's called The Death of Vishnu. Now, one of the characters in your novel bases her romantic fantasies on Indian movies. Your father worked for Indian movies, or maybe still does. What kind of work does he do, or did he do?
Well, he's retired now, but he was an assistant to a music director. The Indian movies I'm talking about are called Bollywood films or masala films. Masala is the mixture of spices you find in Indian food. And these movies are also a mixture of various plot elements. There's always 6 or 7 or 8 or now even 14 songs and dances. There's fights and there is a villain and there's comedy and there's a lot of romance. And there has to be at least some tragedy so that you can pull out your handkerchief.
And it's all pretty broad.
It's broad, but it's also, in some ways, reassuringly predictable. You know what's going to happen, and the audience is waiting for these things, and they enjoy it immensely. And it's unfortunate that in this country, only the art films from India are usually available. These films are very entertaining, and the character in my book that you mentioned, Kavita, she's completely enthralled by them, and she really thinks of herself as the heroine of a Hindi movie.
And is there any like particular fantasy that you have that you think really comes out of the movies that you grew up with?
Well, I think there's a lot of things that not just I, but maybe a number of people in India would think about that are derived from the movies. I think movies are really a common thread that binds together society or runs through society there. If I'd asked the real Vishnu about movies, he would probably know the names of actors and so on. I did try to put myself in the place of Kavita and think about, well, what fantasies could I engineer in her head? And the one that I came up with is a well-known plot element that she falls in love with a Muslim boy. She's Hindu. And this always causes problems. And There's a famous line in movies, in Hindi movies, this marriage cannot take place. And I managed to squeeze that into the book as well.
What were the popular books that your generation read?
While I was growing up, people did not buy books that much. They're very expensive in India. What people did was go to circulating libraries, which are much like video circulating libraries here. And so you rented out books. As a result, you only had a limited selection, and that was mostly bestseller related. So there were many, many volumes by Harold Robbins or Arthur Haley or best-selling authors like that. There used to be a British writer who's not very well known here, a crime-type writer called James Hadley Chase. And that was one of the books that I remember in school we used to read secretly because they were kind of banned. They were considered very bad for us to read.
Would you describe the neighborhood that you grew up in Bombay?
Well, I grew up in I grew up in one room of a large apartment, and we were the only Hindu family. There were three Muslim families living in different rooms of this apartment. We shared a kitchen with one family. There were some common toilets at the end of the flat. My parents still lived there, so a few weeks ago when I went back, that's where I stayed. Downstairs, there's a whole bunch of shops, which have changed somewhat over the years. While I was growing up, there was a panwala. Pan is this betel nut confection. There was a cigarette wala, a man who sells cigarettes. The cigarette wala now has expanded his tiny stall into a giant store. And he's even torn down the wall behind the landing where Vishnu lived and somehow managed to find a way to get into his storeroom that way. And then there used to be a shop that rented out bicycles, which now sells cellular phones.
So you and your parents shared one room?
Yes, we did. It was a large room, but it was shared. And people sometimes ask me if I could have written this book in India, and it would have been very difficult because that's where I might still be staying, and there would still be the fights with the neighbors and so on.
What kind of privacy did you or your parents have sharing one room together?
Not much. And every time I go back, it's quite startling because in Maryland, I live in this house and, you know, there are two bathrooms and I have my own room and everything. And then I'm somehow deposited in this, really, it's like a fishbowl because my parents haven't seen me for a while and they're just always talking to me and so on, which is great, but certainly privacy is not what I go back for.
What kind of conflicts did your family have with the other families that I shared the apartment with?
Oh, just about every kind. You name it. It's just so hard to have a common kitchen. The further complication was that family was actually the landlord of the entire apartment, so we couldn't really... you know, we always had this worry that, well, will we be evicted or something like that? So they were the ones that I remember are there used to be one tank that would feed water to all the families, and that tank usually ran out by noontime or something, and so there were always accusations of the form. Well, you took an extra bath. No, you did, and things like that.
You moved to America in 1979 to go to college. You were 20 at the time. What were your first impressions of America? What did you find most wonderful and most disturbing about it?
Well, the first thing I wanted to do was eat a Big Mac.
Why? What did you hear about it?
I'd just seen so much about it, and I, you know, went down to the McDonald's and ordered my first Big Mac, and it was great saying everything on it. And it was awful. It was horrible. I couldn't believe it. So in some ways, I thought that I knew pretty much everything about America because I'd seen so many Hollywood films. I'd read so many books. I'd read Mad Magazine. I'd read Archie Comics. And so it was all very familiar, actually. And I just felt myself fitting in. I didn't like Big Macs, I found out, but so what?
What were the movies that really formed your impressions of America before you got here?
Oh, there were too many to relate. I'd had a steady diet of them for I don't know how many years. What was interesting was when I came here, there were all these movies that had been banned in India. So for the first year or so, I was just catching up, like Last Tango in Paris and even The Uncensored Godfather, and there were just so many movies.
Was there much sex or violence in Indian cinema?
No, not at all. In fact, the classical thing is that up till recently, in Indian movies, when two people wanted to kiss, when the hero kissed the heroine, they ducked behind a tree so that you wouldn't see them kissing. And then they came out sort of wiping their lips to show that they had just kissed.
Now, how did that approach to not showing any kind of physical encounter affect your approach to writing your novel?
Oh, well, I had to do just the opposite. I had to make sure that I had lots of sex and so on. And it was interesting because I read out parts of this in Bombay where the book was released in January. And my family was in the audience. So I made it a point to read out the sex scenes and watch them squirm.
And they squirmed, huh?
Oh, yes. Not just them, but the whole audience.
Manil Suri, I thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Manil Suri is the author of the new novel, The Death of Vishnu. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's some music from Bollywood. This is from a collection of South Indian film music. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Division, publisher of Total Memory Workout, 8 Easy Steps to Maximum Memory Fitness by Cynthia R. Green. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, teaching Shakespeare in a remote Chinese town where foreigners have not been allowed for decades. We talk with Peter Hessler about his 2 years as a Peace Corps volunteer in Fulong, China. He writes about his experiences in the new book, Rivertown. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. No American had lived in Fuling, China for half a century when Peter Hessler arrived there in 1996. He was 27 years old and had come through the Peace Corps to teach English and English literature to Chinese college students who were preparing to teach English themselves. Fuling is a poor and remote city on the Yangtze River in the Sichuan province. It's one of the places that will be flooded by the controversial Three Gorges Dam. After teaching for 2 years, Hessler moved to Beijing, where he continues to live and work as a journalist. His new book, Rivertown, is about life as an American in China, his experiences teaching, and his reflections about politics and political correctness on Chinese and American campuses. When he started teaching in Fuling, he had his students write down the names of any English books they had read and their thoughts about those books. I asked him to read some of the responses.
My students were studying literature, and I was a little bit leery because I was handed these textbooks that started with Beowulf and went all the way to Faulkner, and this was, you know, not easy stuff. So on the first day of class, I asked them to write down any authors they had read or anybody they'd wanted to read, and these were some of the responses. I enjoyed Hemingway, The Old Man and the Sea. I mostly want to study Hemingway. I've read Jack London and his The Call of the Wild, Dickens and his The Tale of Two Cities, O. Henry and his The Last Leaf, Shakespeare and his King Lear, and that made me burst into tears. Another student wrote, I'm most interested in Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte. I don't know which periods it belonged to. I like Jane. I think she's a very common woman, but she has an uncommon seeking. She dared to resist wife of mother's brother and brother of cousinship. She's a progressive lady. Another student wrote, I have read Farewell Weapons, which is written by Hemingway. He was a tough man, but he killed himself.
I think I particularly like that last one.
Yeah, they were going from the Chinese translation. They tend to like Hemingway a lot. He translates very nicely into Chinese. So him and Jack London are two of the favorite authors of my students.
What do you think it was that spoke to your students about Hemingway or Jack London?
Well, those are two writers who translate very well, just stylistically. So that's part of it, and also they're both the kind of writers who have excellent plots, adventure stories, and I think that also translates easily.
Now you taught Shakespeare to your students among other authors, and it's really difficult for most American students to understand the English of Shakespeare's time. Imagine it would be much more difficult for Chinese students whose understanding of English is still pretty rudimentary to have to learn the English of another era.
Well, we took it slow. For a lot of the plays, I would sort of summarize them, and we would act them out. I'd have the students perform them, and we'd work off of a simplified version. But the poetry, they were just incredibly patient with it. I would work. I would translate the archaisms in any words that were not contemporary. But then after that, we would just go through it line by line, and they were amazingly good at it. But in China, that's really the strength of their cultural tradition. I feel like in America, American students sometimes have trouble approaching poetry because I think the American tradition is more short story and more novel. I think that's what we're strong at. In China, the strength is really in poetry. And any Chinese who is educated at all knows poetry by heart. And this is partly because Chinese poems are short, but it's also because there's more of a value put on them. And so all of my students, they could recite dozens of poems totally from heart.
What were some of the things that your students particularly liked or didn't like about Shakespeare?
They like tragedies, and sometimes the comedies confuse them a bit. But the Chinese traditional classics in China tend to be tragic, so they would like a story like Romeo and Juliet. The Merchant of Venice is very popular in China, but that's popular for political reasons because that play has been touted by the authorities as an expose of capitalism. So that was another component we were working with. When I'm teaching these plays, I'm in a college that's very political. It's run by the Communist Party. And it was very common for students to tell me that they liked Hamlet because he cared so much about the peasants. Students also, when I asked them about A Midsummer Night's Dream, they would write about how the peasants were the most powerful figures in the play because all power comes from the proletariat, and that's how the revolution starts. And it's kind of difficult to respond to this because my students themselves the majority of them came from the countryside. They described their own families as peasant families. So I couldn't really, you know, I wasn't going to tell them that actually Midsummer Night's Dream, they're comic relief. You know, they're the peasants are buffoons. And I had a real mixed reaction to this because I felt like it was wonderful to see my students interacting with the text, and it was great to see them making connections. You know, they're taking a play and connecting it with their own lives in Sichuan province. But at the same time, I wasn't so enthusiastic about Shakespeare being used for Communist Party propaganda. So it was an issue. And, you know, often I would say, for example, I had students who told me that Shakespeare was a great author because he promoted the working classes and because he opposed capitalism. And I said, well, actually, you know, he made his fortune off buying stock in a theater company. You know, he was a capitalist. So we would sort of have some slight battles there. But in the end, they were very good at just sort of focusing at the story itself. That was really what I liked the most about teaching them.
Now, some of the political correctness that you found disturbing in China has kind of, you found similar problems in the United States when you were a student.
Well, there's certainly connections. I think that any time, especially as a literature teacher, I would find that my students were often pushing the Communist Party's ideas into the text, and we would have students telling me, as I said, that, you know, that Hamlet is a great character because he cares about the peasantry, and they're just sort of taking these ideas that they've been taught and bringing them to this text. And it's not that much different from somebody in America who's, say, a Marxist and who believes that every play is about the oppression of the working man, or somebody who's a feminist and always taking that tack. And they're both examples of people, instead of reacting to a text, you're bringing your ideas there. And it was interesting for me to see that for the first time outside of American literature programs.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Peter Hessler, and he's the author of the new book, Rivertown, which is about the 2 years that he spent through the Peace Corps in a small city in China, teaching English to Chinese students. An excerpt of that book was published in The New Yorker. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Peter Hessler, and his new memoir, Rivertown, is about the 2 years he spent in China in a small town called Fuling, teaching English to Chinese students through the Peace Corps. Now, there were aspects of Chinese politics and propaganda that cropped up within the curriculum that were somewhere between very disturbing and very ridiculous. And I think one example is in a textbook that your friend Adam from the Peace Corps taught in his American culture class, and that book was called Survey of Britain and America. It was published in 1994, which is pretty recent. And read us an excerpt from the passage about homosexuality.
Okay. This was from a chapter. This book was intended to give sort of history and culture of America, and one of the chapters was called Social Problems. And this chapter read, "The American society is developing very fast scientifically, while the spirit of the society is becoming more and more hollow, and the society itself more and more corrupted." And then they talked about a number of problems, for example, premarital sex, and then they came to homosexuality, and the chapter continued, "Homosexuality is a rather strange social phenomenon that most people can hardly understand. It widely spreads. One reason for this may be the despair in marriage or love affairs. Some people fail in marriage and become disappointed with it. So they decide no longer to love the opposite sex, but instead begin to love a person of the same sex as a return of hatred to the opposite. Another reason may be that some people want to find and do something new and curious, because the Americans are known as adventurous." And then the text continued to give some reasons for this, and the final reason was, "However, the most important reason is the capitalist system of America. In this capitalist society, although science and technology is highly advanced, some people are suffering from spiritual hollowness. Thus, they start to look for things curious and exciting. Therefore, only when the American capitalist system is ended can all these social problems be solved." So you essentially had a text that was telling the students that capitalism causes homosexuality.
Was there anything else in that textbook we've been talking about, The Survey of Britain and America, that you found particularly interesting or revealing in the Chinese government's interpretation of American culture?
Well, the problem with that textbook is there was a lot of stuff in there that was true. I mean, the textbook also criticized American racism and criticized sexism in America and criticized the class system. And it was a real hard aspect of teaching there because you're certainly not going to tell them that those things are not issues in America. So it's, you know, it was hard because you had to say, well, you know, I think this part of this book is not very accurate. I think this is a stereotype or an exaggeration. But some of these problems that they are pointing out in America are accurate. And, you know, I felt like as a teacher, that was a very hard thing to do, is that I didn't want to play into anybody's propaganda. You know, I didn't want to help the government criticize America for unfair reasons, but I don't want to paint a picture of America as a place that has everything figured out. I think that's far from the truth. And I think one of the most viable things that people in other countries can realize is that America has a lot of the same issues that they're dealing with. And so that was one of my goals as a teacher there.
What kind of political debates did you try to get going in class?
Again, this was something you had to be very careful with. And for the most part, we tried to avoid it. It's a situation where the students tend to clam up if the material becomes very political. And it also became very tedious because you hear the same thing over and over. So most of the teachers I knew, most of the foreign teachers, would try to avoid it. But when we did talk about it, we would usually, you had to find a roundabout way to do it. For example, when I talked about Robin Hood in my literature class, we talked about ballads, and we read a ballad about Robin Hood, and we talked about him as a hero. And I asked my students, is he a good role model for Chinese people today? And that was an interesting instance because it split them right down the middle. And you had one half of the class saying, Robin Hood is like Mao Zedong. He's a revolutionary. He supports the common people. He's like a communist. And then you had the other half of the class saying, you know, we can't have this kind of disruption in society. This is the same thing as if you have massive protests or any kind of turmoil. We need stability. Which really it's sort of a touchstone to one of the big issues in China today, which is which side of this propaganda are you going to follow? Because you have a country that still worships revolution and still promotes a very romanticized view of rebellion and violence as far as the 1949 communist revolution, but is also trying to promote the status quo and to avoid any challenge to the authority of the party.
Were there certain subjects that were too controversial for you to touch, or certain books that you weren't allowed to teach?
Well, you would never talk about the protests in 89.
Tiananmen Square.
Yeah, that would never be talked about. And to be honest, my students had very little clue what had happened. They were aware that there had been protests. They knew that there had been some violence. But quite a few of them weren't even aware that people had died, and they certainly had no idea of the numbers. The town I was teaching is very far from Beijing, but I was really surprised, and that was the first time I realized how uninformed a lot of people are in these parts of China. So that's something you didn't talk about. You wouldn't criticize the one-child policy. You certainly wouldn't criticize the one-party system.
Peter Hessler is my guest, and his new book, Rivertown, is about the 2 years that he spent teaching in a small city in China, teaching English to Chinese students through the Peace Corps. You've written a book about your experiences in China, and you've also written articles for various magazines. Some of those articles are excerpts of the book, but others, I think, were not. What was it like trying to figure out what editors in different magazines would be interested in? Like, what kind of stories you could pitch, the travel magazine versus the Atlantic or the New Yorker?
I think one of the problems with writing about China is that I think everybody wants to see political stories. And that is an interesting aspect of the place, and it is the last major communist country. But at the same time, I'm not convinced it's always the most accurate story because the average Chinese, for example, the person who might be opening a noodle shop or the person who, you know, who might be a peasant, that average Chinese person doesn't have a lot of contact with the political authorities and doesn't it doesn't have a lot of interest sometimes. And that was one thing about my experience that wasn't very representative, in that I was at a college, which is a very political environment. But the more that I spoke Chinese and the more that I talked with average people in Fuling, the more I realized that they didn't really feel this political weight that I had sort of assumed everybody in China had. And I think it, now as a journalist in Beijing, I still feel the same way. The people that I tend to come in contact with in Beijing are more political. There's a lot of intellectuals there. It's a political city. But I don't think that's representative of China. So I think sometimes when we write about the country, we get so obsessed with the politics that we miss some of the most important stories. And a lot of those are just about people finding new ways to do things.
I think one of the articles that you wrote from China had to do with restaurants that served rat in various recipes. And I'm wondering if you thought at all that that might kind of play into stereotypes or the yuck factor too much. Tell me what went through your mind before doing that story.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, that is a story that I think that of all the stories I've written, that's probably the one that's gotten the most attention, and it's probably not the most representative story. I mean, but I do feel like another aspect of China that doesn't get written about is the humor. It's not a gray place in that sense. I think sometimes it seems very grim to us. It seems like people there are under enormous pressure, and actually, there's a lot of laughter there. A lot of people think things are fine. There's also a lot of just simply very funny things going on. That story about the rat restaurant, I went to a city that had set up a special economic zone to promote their local specialty, which was rat, and they were promoting this as good for people's health, as they said that it turned your hair black, it kept you in it, and it would help prevent baldness. And there were competing rat restaurants with the same, you know, with the same dishes next door to each other, and it was, I thought it was pretty funny, and the Chinese people think it's funny too. So I think that's, you know, I was a little bit leery of trying, of people getting the impression that everybody in this country is doing things like this. But at the same time, I think it's worthwhile for people to realize that it's not all serious over there, and it's not all sort of communist pressure and Falun Gong and political repression.
So I might as well ask what your favorite rat dish was and how it tasted.
I think the spicy rat was the best one I had. It was fine. I mean, the problem with rat is it doesn't fall too far from the tree. I mean, you look at it and, you know, you can recognize that this thing used to be a rat, and it's got these little kind of cute ribs, and the other problem is that they want to show you the rat before they cook it, because that's a tradition in China. For example, if you buy a fish, if you're eating fish at a restaurant, they'll always bring the fish out and show it to you, and just so you can approve it, just like in an American restaurant, they bring you the bottle of wine, and in the rat restaurant they always had me approve the rats, and that was a bit rough as well.
My guest is Peter Hessler, author of Rivertown. We'll talk more about his experiences in China after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Peter Hessler, author of Rivertown, about his 2 years teaching English to Chinese college students in Fuling, a city on the Yangtze River in the Sichuan province of China. Are there any American movies, books, recordings that have really caught on in China that you see or hear differently in China than you would if you were in the U.S. looking or listening or reading?
Well, when I was in the Peace Corps, probably the biggest one was Titanic. I mean, that movie was incredibly popular in China, and even Jiang Zemin, the premier endorsed it and said that it promoted the correct class viewpoint because the hero Jack is a is lower class figure, and so everybody in China saw it. You heard that song everywhere. I had my students were translating that, and when I came back to America, I tutored at a local elementary school, and I tutored a little boy who had just come in from China and spoke no English, and he was allowed to choose his English name. And he chose the name Jack, you know, from the character in the Titanic. So that was enormous in 1998, and even now you can still find that movie in theaters.
Do you think that movie looked any different to you in China than it might have looked had you still been living in the U.S.?
I think in the U.S. I probably would have been more scornful of it. I think usually when something is very popular in America, I think you tend to sort of criticize it or try to deny its importance. But I think maybe in China, when something's that popular, I was more interested in, well, why is this connecting? What is it about this movie that appeals to people? And obviously, a lot of it was, you know, this story of somebody crossing class barriers, and you know, this is something that's becoming an issue again in China, and you know, in a country with enormous economic development. So it was, in some ways, I took it more seriously there, I think, than I would in America.
Do you feel like your personality has changed while living in China?
Well, one thing I write about is you sort of develop a Chinese personality as you learn the language, and you do that with any language. The person that you are in French or Spanish is not the same person you are in English, and I think that's one of the real benefits of learning a language is you sort of step outside of yourself and you're watching yourself interact, and it's an unusual experience if most of your life is in English. And you know, in Chinese, I can't speak as well as I do in English. I have a heavy accent. You know, I found myself that I was much more willing to laugh at myself. I was in some ways more laid back with that personality. And also because I was trying to talk to people and trying to learn Chinese, I was open. If somebody sat next to me, I wanted to talk to him. I don't do that in America. If I'm on a plane and I'm sitting next to somebody, I'll probably fall asleep or read a book. But in China, I was always interested, partly because I was just trying to improve my language skills. But it also helped me learn about average people.
I always really regret that the only language I really understand or speak is English. And it just, you know, limits my ability to travel through the world and be able to communicate while doing it. Do you miss being able to, say, tell jokes to people in China because or understand their jokes or irony? That's the kind of thing that really requires having language work on several levels at one time, which you can only do when you're really comfortable with the language.
I think it's you know, you can't do, you know, I can't do very sophisticated jokes or sophisticated humor, but there's other things that for example, if I were when I was in Fuling, I would always refer to myself as the foreign devil, which was kind of an old-time insult for foreigners, and people found that hilarious, you know, that I would refer to myself in those terms as if it was a great honorific. And so it was actually pretty easy to still joke around, and you could poke fun at yourself pretty easily as a foreigner, and your accent was funny. If you spoke the local dialect, people found that hilarious to have a foreigner speaking a little bit of Sichuanese. So I didn't really feel like that part was cut off. If anything, I had to be more relaxed and more humorous in that language.
Do you find that your personal relations with Chinese people is affected at all by the status of the Chinese government-American government relations of the moment?
Well, I think the relations between our countries are very complicated, and relations between me and my Chinese friends were at moments complicated for the very same reasons. I think these are two cultures that make a really interesting mix, and I think there's a real attraction, but at the same time there's you know, there's a certain repulsion. I think there's a lot of similarities. I think the main similarity is that when you're comparing America and China, these are both incredibly self-centered and really, I think, pretty arrogant cultures and countries. And I think it's very hard for Americans sometimes to see the outside world clearly, and it's very hard for Chinese to do that as well. And we come to that, I think, for different reasons. I feel like the Chinese are incredibly proud of this 5,000 years of continuous civilization, of this incredibly rich culture. They're proud of being the first to have invented so much technology, but at the same time there's a bit of an insecurity about their current state in the world and their status since the 19th century on. There's a bit of an inferiority complex there. And I feel like Americans are incredibly proud of our current condition, the fact that our political power, our economic might. But I think there's a bit of an insecurity on our end on the cultural level. I think sometimes Americans sort of worry about the sort of things that we're exporting to other countries as far as movies and music, and sometimes worry about the cheapness of our culture. So I think it makes for a fascinating relationship between these two countries. And I think naturally there's a lot of tension, but naturally there's also a lot of attraction. I think the Chinese look at America and are fascinated by the sort of power of and success of our country. I think Americans look at China and are fascinated by the richness of that culture.
Are you still interested in teaching, and would you want to teach in the United States?
I'm interested. I think it would have been hard to go straight from China to the U.S. I had some friends in the Peace Corps who did that, and I think they found it difficult because they're used to being in a classroom where the students were pretty easy to teach. I mean, they were so eager. They were so happy to have an outsider there. You didn't have certainly no issue of discipline. And I think it would be a little hard to shift back. But I think eventually I would be interested in teaching maybe at the college level. Because the one thing that I did miss while I was there was that sense of questioning the teacher and questioning the system. And I think that's one thing that the American schools have that the Chinese don't, is that in America you're not supposed to accept what you hear. And that was, if there was one lesson that I was trying to push on my students, it was that one. You know, go ahead, don't believe what's written in your textbooks. Don't believe what I say necessarily. I mean, take it all with a grain of salt and do your own research. But I think that lesson is much more natural here in America than in China.
Well, Peter Hessler, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Peter Hessler is the author of Rivertown, 2 Years on the Yangtze. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Monique Nazareth, with Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howe, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Roberta Shurock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the creator of Survivor and the creator of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Each of these men is British and is licensed to show to countries around the world. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.